This is Steve Hurley, and welcome to the Pivotal Outdoors Podcast, discussing hunting, fishing, and outdoor pursuits, swapping stories and feeling alive. All right, welcome back to the Pivotal Outdoors Podcast. I'm here with Derek Langway today, and we're going to be talking about duck hunting. It's kind of like a two parts of this episode. The first part, we're going to talk about this hunt we went on the end of December, which is really cool. And then the second part will be a follow-up to the Suicide Ducks episode two, on gaining entry into duck hunting. How can you do it affordably? And tips and tricks around that. So, Derek, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we went duck hunting with our friend Cass, and we went guided, and it was with Widewater Waterfowl, which is a pretty famous area with Jerry Decatur. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, I just call him Crabman.
Yeah, also known as Crabman.
Calls him Crabman.
Yeah, I just didn't want to botch that and say it multiple times throughout the podcast. So that's how I addressed him, was Crabman. And just for the listeners, Crabman, he has that name because he does crabbing, I guess, the rest of the year outside of hunting season. And he's known for crabs down near Widewater in the Quantico area, right? He sells them at on the road, I believe. Is that what Kess was saying?
Kinda. He doesn't do a whole lot of that fancy stuff. They have basically like a food truck style for their cooked crabs when it's nice outside. They do have a storefront that's down in Fredericksburg or around that area. Oh man. And I think that crab season is open for such a short period that he just kinda pivots to a natural obsession that he's already on the water. He's already seeing them on a regular basis. And it just kind of is a logical next step for him running that guiding. I did put a couple notes on Jerry and the Crabman. He started guiding in 1994, which, I mean, I was in like elementary school at that time, you know?
Yeah,
so
me too.
He's been doing it a long while. We saw just a small part of what he had, but like his fleet, if you would call it that, of crab boats and just the number of blinds that he has available and set up to go for all of the different conditions. It's staggering.
Yeah. So, I guess before we jump into like the option we picked, it was kind of interesting to me hearing some of the stuff about kind of how people are pretty defensive about their blinds, even though it's on a public waterway. And I know people are hunting from boats, but I think he was talking about how he had most of the blinds along the river in Virginia locked up, correct?
Yeah. The Virginia water access is fairly limited. So everything that's all like on the Potomac and bordering, it's not a 50-50, like a waterway type of thing. It's all of that is Maryland water, and the riparian area and the inn is Virginia.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, like,
you could see it right on Google Maps.
Yeah.
Like the dotted line is right on the coast of Virginia.
And so like that's a part of the reason why like the Virginia, it's not easy to lock up, but with the statutes being the way they are, you have to be 500 meters we went to the moon. So it's yards. So from the next blind, which means that if he has a blind within 1,000 yards of each other, by law, even if it's unoccupied, you can't set up a temporary or a semi-permanent or even a floating blind legally. I things get contentious on these waters. So that's why, that's a part of the reason why like riparian access is such a big deal, at least here on the shoreline of Northern Virginia, which is where we're at.
That being said, I guess for our hunt, we were not in a blind on the coast or in the bushes or riparian region, but we were actually out in the water. We signed up for the premier crabman hunt. So it was a floating blind, and this was the coolest floating blind I've ever seen and definitely ever been on. Essentially, it was a houseboat. I remember just riding out there in the dark, and it's like, okay, we're riding out to the blind, and we're getting closer, and it's all brushed in, and we're basically taxiing through 100 duck decoys, really. Just everything's laid out perfect, it seemed like. And we jump off and get in the boat. This is before shooting light, so it's in the dark. And stepping into the boat and being like, wow, that there's a TV on, there's two Lazy Boys, it had a bathroom in the back, they had coffee, sandwiches, donuts, everything was set. And that was actually pretty cool, just hanging out before shooting light, just, you know, starting to enjoy the day. And then,
yeah, cause I was halfway expecting what I'm used to is just a 2x4 plywood structure that's poorly brushed in. And that would be our floating blind. And when we came up to it and it just kept getting bigger and bigger, cause I was expecting like a pontoon boat, and like, it felt more like a houseboat than just a standard pontoon.
Yeah. And I forgot that we were doing the premier, cause he had a couple other services that could be with some of his other guides, which were still great, but they had smaller boats, and we wanted to be with Jerry, the crab man, just for the full experience and talk to him. So before knowing we're going to be out in the boat, I had this picture in my mind that I didn't have waders. I was hoping I don't get too wet because it's going to be cold. So I was thinking we're going to be like rocking, you know, ankle deep water, sitting on a small stool like the whole day, not even knowing that food, coffee, water. For lunch, we had ribeye, oysters. I mean, it was pretty bougie, and it was actually really nice. And I thought it was cool. Any thoughts on that, Derek, on your expectation?
Yeah. It was way more luxurious than I had anticipated. I knew we were going to get sandwiches, and I mean, he's the crab man, so having oysters, man, they were good and hot too. And it was just really great. They were fresh, but I don't know exactly what I was expecting, but it definitely exceeded what I had in my mind's eye.
Yeah, and I think this would be a great gateway hunt. You know, if you're trying to get a spouse or your kids into it, or even if you just wanted to have, I mean, it would be great for like a bachelor party because people could hang out inside. There's plenty of space to line up and be ready to shoot. If it did get too cold and bitter, I mean, you could step inside for a little bit. It was, I mean, it'd be good for anyone. Anyone would enjoy it, you know?
Yeah. I don't know if it'd be good to get my son like interested in waterfowl, because it would be the only time he felt comfort going duck hunting. Like he would get this false sense of like expectation that's how it is duck hunting every single day. And then we wade out in like frigid water, breaking ice up to our knees, and like sloshing a dozen decoys in a canoe, and like, but Dad, where's the hot oysters?
Yeah. Where's my warm coffee? Why isn't the TV on?
Yeah. Where is the TV? Like, why aren't we doing that this time? That's what I think duck hunting should be. So I can see how it being that great for their first time would completely smash expectations.
Yeah.
Like they wouldn't know some of the miserable conditions
they probably wouldn't think it's as cool. That would be the default. I guess I'm thinking it's cool because even just deer hunting, I'm used to just being cold, questioning if I should be out there. There's very little comfort. So I guess you got to go through that uncomfortable period to be like, whoa, this style is like amazing.
And the term suffer in silence really means something when you're doing that, like sitting in a tree stand, waiting for questioning every decision you made up to that point. And then like, I still have to be whisper quiet and not move and just continue to fight back shivers. It was a nice break. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Some different change of pace. And it was cool. Just hanging out and talking. Because they had guides on that boat with us. Crabman was there. And then there was two other guides. They're on the roof of this structure that was brushed in, just to give you an idea, a two-story blind. And I really appreciate that they were very attentive, very friendly, and they were continually keeping eyes on the water. With binos.
They were calling out ducks.
Yeah. And so we could actually relax a little bit and, you know, be chatting a little bit, and they said, oh, from the left, here comes four or whatever. And then we could be like locked on in a second, see if they came in close enough. So that it is a different pace, but it was kind of refreshing. Conditions wise, we could see flocks of ducks like in the distance floating in large groups on the water. The water was like really still this morning. I mean, it was a great sunrise, but not as much action early on. And how big would you think some of these groups were? I mean, I was having a tough time, but I didn't bring my glasses most of the time. So I'm like, I sort of see that floating kind of blob. And the guys were like, yep, that's a bunch of ducks over here under that tower. That's a duck. So they were definitely dialed in on seeing and being able to call specific ducks.
So the big raft of ducks that was on the Maryland side of the sound, they said that it was upwards of 1,000 ducks, but it wasn't going to come our direction just because allowing it. So with as cold as it had been, all of the ducks went from small water that was getting frozen up out to the big water. But because there was no wind, nothing to push them and do anything, they called it a lazy day. And so that's why their spread was as huge as it was. I think he said that there was 150 plus decoys. They were spread out almost 360. The only thing that was left open was our shooting lane, which was about 20, 25 degrees of shooting our direction. And he called that our killing hole. But yeah, the birds were landing in all different areas of the spread, not just places that we had access to. So depending on, you know, where they were coming from, there was quite a few times that they would land behind our boat and the guides were calling them out. Hey, three ducks just landed over here. We're going to see, you know, we're going to keep an eye on them and see if any more flare into our set. So it was kind of like things working against us, but honestly, like anytime that ducks land in your spread and after getting there, don't immediately like fly away, you've done something right.
Yeah. Like they're buying into, oh, I'm landing with actual ducks. And then they even double as live decoys.
Yeah. Because they're calling, they're rippling, they're feeding, they're just playing games, keep like sunning themselves off and flapping and flaring. So it was good. Yeah. He called them just, lazy rafts of ducks. And we definitely saw it. The funny thing is that you couldn't even see the 1,000 ducks that were shimmering in the distance. Like we had, I think, he pulled his binos down and we like, when I got eyes on it, I was like, wow, can we just canoe over there and see what happens? It's like, no, that's Maryland waters. So we had to stay in our cove, essentially.
Even though it didn't work out early on, it kind of worked out later, I guess later in our hunt, in that like late morning, early afternoon, all of a sudden we started getting a lot of action, which was great, at least compared to the morning. And most of the ducks, or pretty much all of them, they referred to them as just black ducks. But they were, I guess, scalps, right? Greater and lesser scalp, which is a diving duck or sea duck style. You know, at different times of the year, this is the end of December. I guess the colder it is, the more miserable. You know, they don't have those lazy rafts, those lazy days. So you could see different variety of ducks depending on what time you're actually getting out there on the water. They were really good. I guess you get an eye for seeing ducks flying in, because to me they all look like black ducks, because they're all just black dots until they get real close. And he's picking things out while they're flying. It's like, oh no, that's a canvasback. Oh no, that's a black duck. That's something else, which is really cool. And I feel like I really want to get better at really learning the ducks, how to pick them out, and any little differences. Because I mean, they were beautiful once we got them back in the boat.
Oh yeah. Well, and the thing that I realized is he was identifying the ducks based on their flight patterns and how they responded to his calls. And it's something that I would not have thought. Because remember, the one duck we weren't allowed to shoot is not even a duck, it's the cormorants. Because they're federally protected here, or they're protected here, and from a big distance, there was, I want to say there was like 5 or 8 of them, and just by the way they were calling and where, or the way they were flying and where they were at, he was like, those are either geese or cormorants. And then he gave them a hail call and they basically responded to him and broke their formation and started and turned to come see us. And he was like, see, those weren't the geese that we were looking for, because they would have responded this way and they would have turned in a different manner. They would have stayed in formation. Whereas the cormorants, they just all turned on their own and started flying towards us. And yeah. I was like, that is the coolest thing ever. And I wouldn't have known that if this guy with, you know, 30 years of experience hadn't sat down and explained it.
And once you get that level, I feel like you just love it so much more, because it's not just, oh yeah, here comes some ducks and you shoot them, they fall out of the sky. It's, there's the small nuance of particular species, different calls. Cause we didn't, you were calling, I didn't do any calling. But just having different types of calls, if they fly one way, hit them with this call, try this. I feel like that's when you really, like, once you get to that level, you're like, you're crazy about ducks. You just gotta love it, you know? And I get that bug bit a little bit with turkey. I just gotta learn more about duck. I only make the one sound every time. I mean, you were making, what was the kind of the call you were doing? It was like it wasn't just a quack, but it was like they were like just hanging around doing something, staying busy or something. What were you doing?
So, for me, I've been told that I'm a terrible caller, and I accept that. But the best advice I was given is I need to learn two basic things. One is the quack, and then the other is a feed call. Like, I've got a ATM green machine. It's a zinc call, and it's a great entry level call because it's quality, but it's not expensive. And I've literally spent the last year bothering my wife. I actually am not allowed to do blow duck calls inside the house. I'm actually not allowed to blow any calls inside the house, because depending on what time of year it is, it's either a squirrel, a deer, like it sounds like a zoo. I'm like Dr. Doolittle. But those were the two calls that I have spent the last year practicing, and it was the feed call, and it was just the basic quack. Like for me, I am not particularly good at it, but I don't have to be that great at it because they just hear the noise of the whole thing. And I was mainly using it to ID to the guides up on the top. Instead of screaming, "I see a duck," I would pull out my duck call and start a feeding call. And then we would give them a direction, whether it was cast on the left side saying it's coming from the 3 o'clock, 200 meters, or you were on the right side calling out what you saw. And I was just giving them the audio cue. It's like, "Hey, we just keyed up on something."
I actually picked up on that.
Yeah. So yeah. I was doing the feed call. I'm pretty comfortable with that one. My quack is awful. Yeah. Like, but when you're doing like a hail call, it just needs to be loud and crisp. I have a few other calls on my lanyard, but I'm not going to embarrass myself in a blind with, our guide had more experience than we'd been alive. So it's like, I'm not going to try and outcall him.
Yeah.
But I was using it as like an indicator that we had seen something.
Yeah.
And that, so it was more our communication to our guides or whomever.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you can't see everything. Like they were monitoring 360 degrees.
Yeah. And they did a fantastic job. I was really impressed with just how everything went. Especially if they're in binos, you know, you can't see something coming at your 6 o'clock.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you mentioned, just jump on a tangent real quick. You mentioned different calls and you said there's a squirrel call. What do you use call squirrels with? Like what's that? Is it like an air tube call or do you do something different?
It's a two part, barker. So it has a bark. So it's shaped like, it's like a 2-inch barrel tube, like a hard plastic tube. It has a, if you blow into the wrong end of it, it lets out a high pitch, like screaming squeal. And then if you slap the plunger on the opposite side that's holding the whole thing in there, almost like one of those, bicycle honkers.
Oh yeah.
Like if you hit that, it'll make a squirrel bark. I basically use it. If I see a squirrel in a tree, I'll bark at it to try and get it to stop. If I'm within like shooting range and he's not like keyed into me being a threat, I'll hit the bark. It'll stop them. They're inquisitive. They'll poke their head out and I may or may not have a shot at that point. The other way I use it is right after they put their whelps, they finish their breeding season and they have their baby squirrels. I'll do a squirrel in distress call, and every squirrel within a quarter mile is going to run and bark and chatter.
Really?
And some of them even come to you. Yeah.
That's awesome. I wanted to test that out. There's a cheap little poor man's trick that I do is I get two quarters and you know how there's like ridges on the edge of the quarter?
Yep.
You just rub them back and forth on each other and it makes a sound of like they're like chewing or like, I don't have the quarters on me now, but if you do that and just close your eyes, you would picture like a squirrel just like gnawing on something or like picking at their teeth or doing something crazy. And I've had some success where I do that. Like, I saw them run up a tree and they're on the other side or behind a branch, and I do that, and then they come on the other side. But I might have to invest in a little squirrel barker.
They have a dedicated squirrel whistle, but I'm too afraid of swallowing the thing. Because what you're supposed to do, yeah, I know, it's super dangerous. What you're supposed to do is you put it, you basically like smile with your teeth clamped together, and you put it against your teeth, and you wrap your lips around it, and then you suck in as hard as you can. And supposedly it makes a perfect, like, aggravated squirrel sound.
So something you definitely don't let your kids try, especially if they're young.
Yeah, because I see me, like, going, whoop, and, like, yeah, sucking in on the thing and just, like, catching it. And it's, you know, halfway down my gullet by the time I reel I made.
Well, at least you died doing what you like, you know? Yeah, that's I think I'll start with the barker first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I know it's a side tangent. I was just kind of curious.
I'm going to put us back into the duck conversation. Three best shots of the day.
I want to hear them, because I have an idea of what you're going to say, but I honestly don't.
So for me, my favorite part was Kess. He actually brought two shotguns because he had just purchased another one with a different choke, and then he had his Old Faithful. And with two different shotguns and on two different ducks, he had what we can only consider a magic pattern, because there was a duck-sized hole in his pattern, because I know for a fact he didn't miss, because on one of them, it was his shot all day. It was flying like a straight path away from him, and he patterned that thing and he nailed like right there where it was. And then on another one, after he switched shotguns and after we made fun of him mercilessly for a little while, he had another opportunity and he took two shots and peppered that duck, and both times both of those ducks flew away practically unscathed. So I guess it wouldn't be like the best shot, but it was the most memorable. And then
because BBs were even falling, I mean, even the guides agreed, and like BBs were hitting the water below, like above, further out, and left and right of this thing. It wasn't just like our call. Everyone was like, oh wow, that should be a dead duck.
Yeah, and the first time everyone's like, okay, yeah, of course, you were right on.
Yeah.
Of course. But like the guy that was right next to him was like, no, I swear, like he peppered that thing and that should be a dead duck, but it's not. And then on the second time, everybody was in concurrence that Cass is just a unlucky son of a gun. My favorite shot was after both you and Cass had gotten your ducks in the water, and I had one injured duck that flew off. I finally had what I would call like the perfect shot, and because the whole morning there was this 20 degree empty spot. It was like the landing strip of what was supposed to be the killing hole. And it seems like every single duck wanted to land either just on the outside of the pattern on Cass's side to the left, or just on the outside of the pattern on your side to the right. And I was standing in the middle of this killing hole, and nothing was coming in. And they would fly like really fast across the aft of the boat. And I wasn't putting them down, but there was one duck that Kess shot at, and then it decided mid flight to go out the path of the killing hole. And I folded that duck, and it felt so good to know that I was the one that shot it, because I was getting a little antsy, and I didn't know if I was going to get anything, but I got one down, and I was pretty happy about that.
Yeah. And that you're the lone shot. Cause sometimes it gets a little crazy when they fly in and you got two or three people shooting and you're like, yeah, I'm pretty sure that guy got that one. But there's a seed of doubt where you're like, I'm pretty sure that was me, but you know, it's not as clear cut. So when it's like, when you hit it yourself, it's like, boom, there's no question. I put that duck in the water. It's a good feeling.
Yeah. Cause there was one bird that it was like, did I shoot it? Did you shoot it? Cause we both shot at almost the same time. And that was the one that was crippled, and they had to almost chase it down with the boat, probably 500 yards.
Oh, and also there was a Franken duck. I think Kes hit it, and then it came across. I hit it, and then the guide went out, and they're like, okay, it's a really injured duck. You know, we're going to go and grab it. And they shot it twice.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and then oh my gosh.
When they got it back into the blind, it was still alive. After they wrung its neck and after they had done it. And I was like, wow.
Yeah. Like, the will to live in this little duck is very strong.
Yeah. Well, the one I was talking about is when you and I shot at the same time, and it looked like it went down, and then it just landed way out there. And they were like, if we run up on it really fast, I think that it being injured, it won't be able to get away, and they'll be able to put it down.
Oh yeah.
And it just didn't happen. And it's like two of us shot it. I mean, they might have just been armored up or something. But it was nuts. And then the best shot of the day was by far your 1 foot butt on the rest trick shot, to where you basically had to be a sniper with the shotgun, because it came around the blind. Kes missed, I missed. You were the only one that had a chance, and it had wrapped around the right side, and it was going towards the bow of the boat away from us. And you put your butt on the rest, leaning outside the blind, offhanded, shot that duck, and it was just like, poo. And then you're like, yep, got it.
Yeah. And I was a little surprised too.
Me and Kes were like, you're kidding, right? Did you just level that duck? And you're like, you know, sometimes you got it. Yeah, it was awesome.
Can you imagine if I fell in? How hilarious that would have been.
Oh, I would have. Oh.
Like leaning off the boat, you know, a toe just on the ground, really.
Yeah, because we must have been in like 5 or 6 feet of water. It wasn't incredibly deep, but you know what? It's a little too deep for what, two warming layers, some random stuff on, like pants and heavy boots. Yeah. You would have been pretty wet dog.
Yeah. At least I would have been able to go inside, you know, with a bougie blind.
Oh yeah. I'm sure there's a hot shower or a sauna out back. Turns out there was a hot tub at the top of the blind, and they tricked us the whole time.
I know. I never went up there. I wish I went up there at least in the morning just to see what they had up there. Cause they had the grill up there.
They had a Blackstone, a charcoal grill, couple of couches, I suppose. I went onto their Facebook page and was checking out some of the, some of the shots. Man, those guys know how to do it in style.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I definitely recommend Widewater Waterfowl. To anybody listening and not knowing what to pick, you won't be disappointed. Even on like a slower day, I mean, we still got our limit of scalp, or black ducks. And yeah, it was just a nice day. Good food, hanging out. It was definitely, I would say it's an upgrade from our hunt last year.
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Well, and not only that, but we got an extra 2 to 2.5 hours of hunting, if you remember.
Yeah. And that was a little accidental, right? Because they needed to do some change of oil in the boat, or there was some maintenance thing, but they were going to run out real quick.
Yeah, they had just gotten their unit serviced, and one of them, they were pretty sure the guy didn't put enough oil in the lower unit, and so they couldn't ride the transport boat out. So they took the shuttle boat, which was basically like a much smaller little jet boat, and they ran him back to the marina about 5 miles down the river so that he could buy a couple gallons of oil, bring it all the way back, and then perform the maintenance that was supposed to be done in the first place. So their caution for not ruining their outboard got us an extra 2 hours of hunting, which was pretty awesome.
Yeah.
And it was that point of the day that was like super warm, really nice. We had already gotten quite a bit of time and like had grown comfortable with Crabman and all of the other guides. So it was pretty fun.
Yeah. I mean, they were awesome. That's all I can say. Definitely recommend. Any final thoughts on Crabman and hunting with him, or do you want to move on to the Suicide Ducks update?
No, man. I would like to point out that this was supposed to be a second inaugural Suicide Ducks, but one Peter Pittens wasn't able to come.
We'll get him back out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in that episode 2, that was our first duck hunt, and we went guided just to kind of see how it was. And then you were going to go and see, all right, if getting into this, what is it going to take to, you know, over the course of a year or whatever, just kind of get into duck hunting on a basic level, because we felt like there were barriers to entry when you see dogs, boats, decoys. If you have a boat, then you might need a trailer and you need something to pull it. And it almost like it can just spiral. It can go as high as you want to spend. And getting into duck hunting on your own on a budget, right? And we were talking about $500. That was kind of like your goal, to see if you could do that, which is, I would think, pretty slim when it comes to duck hunting.
I vastly underestimated how much it was going to cost. Or maybe I overestimated how great I was and how little equipment I actually needed. But the thought behind it was, how do you get into duck hunting with $500 and find yourself some pretty good success? And the thing that I found was, you don't. When I actually tallied everything up, I went well over the $500 mark. And even trying to make the math work on the back end in preparation for this podcast, I still, total of baseline, came up to $550. And that's with all the stuff that I already had. That's with the things that I have, you know, accumulated from my whitetail Marine Corps experience and the warming layers and all of that stuff. And so it's a pretty expensive thing to get into for a novice. The thing that I'm realizing is that if you know what you're doing, it's cheap.
Yeah.
So like the cost of knowledge is high. It costs a lot of time. It costs a lot of cold mornings and a lot of Yeti rum tumblers, whatever those are called.
Of coffee.
The coffees in your Yeti cup, because it's the only warm thing putting into your body.
So you're saying a novice, pretty steep, but maybe like if you already have, like I'm assuming if you already have a shotgun, if you can at least grin and bear it and deal with clothes wise. And I guess I wasn't really thinking licenses. Were you factoring that into your cost?
I did factor that into the cost of it.
Okay.
So the cheapskate way of getting into it would be buy a fishing kayak, spend maybe $50 on some blending material. So they have these big mats that are lightweight that you can basically blind out your kayak. Go down a windy creek bed and jump shoot whatever you can find. You're basically using upland bird type of methodology. You're just going down a windy creek. You're trying to surprise a bird so that they'll fly towards you, and then you put it out of the air. So to stay under $500, that's the only thing that you would need to do, is buy a fishing kayak, do that, and then go in there. But when I started like actually looking into duck hunting and waterfowling, like guys pride themselves in being able to call in, you know, flocks and flocks of ducks into their hole, and they, you know, work them, and they come around and they land in their set. And then when the next group comes in, they shoot them out of the hole. And like, that's what I wanted to get. And that's what the $500 hunt was all about. So my base expense, I already had all the camo. It isn't brand new. It isn't matching. It's not perfect. Waterfowl branded stuff, but I had it and it was light toned. And so the camo was free. I already had warming layers, I got totes upon totes of warming layers. I already have a pump action shotgun. Mine is the shotgun that I had growing up as a kid. I had this pump in high school, and I've had it the entire time. I don't know how many shotgun shells I've shucked through it, but it's a workhorse. It's just a Mossberg 500, and it is old. There was the non-toxic shotgun shells, because everything I had was either skeet shooting or for upland birds and partridge, and that's all lead shot. So I had to buy ammo that was the non-toxic steel shot. I put $100 in stamps, because there's the federal stamp, there's a state hunting license, and there's the state specific stamp or waterfowl authorization, and then you have to do a HIP registry, but the HIP is free.
Yeah, and just to go make a touch on the non-toxic shot, usually it's like steel or bismuth, like you're saying, it can't be lead. That's not just you wanted that. That's like a law. Like it has to be non-toxic shot, right? For migrating waterfowl.
Correct.
Because of lead poisoning, and ducks are, you know, they're swallowing things in their gizzard to help break down food, and if we just don't want animals swallowing lead. I know it. I think that was like when they put that into effect, I think there's a lot of unhappy people, but in my mind, it makes sense. I'm fine with it, but that is definitely something you have to do. That's not like an optional thing. You could get in trouble if you just had like your normal, you know, for shooting clays. So.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I spent $100 for waders. I got the cheapest set of, I want to say they were Calcutta, just a set of rubber fishing waders. And yeah, they didn't even last me a full season. And I can kind of go around that as to how I broke all of these rules. Because like I said, I spent way more than $500. I budgeted $50 for decoys. I went on Facebook Marketplace. Could have been Craigslist. I can't remember. It was like a buy and sell, website. A lady was selling them as decorations. They are cork and wood. They were kind of moldy and gross, and they didn't have lines on them or lead. They were literally decoration. And so I took them, I painted them, and they're really ugly, and I don't know if they're fooling the ducks, but they're definitely not fooling me.
I think they look pretty good. I saw a few of them.
Oh, that's right. I do still have a few of the bodies in the bathroom downstairs.
So I wonder if this lady's husband knew she was selling all his hunting gear.
Yeah, it could be. I also have a friend who gave me 6 floating goose decoys. You know, he just gave them to me as a gift because he doesn't hunt geese on the water. And only having 6 goose decoys, it doesn't draw the numbers that him and his buddies want. So he uses like Bigfoots in the fields, and they've got hundreds of those things. And then I budgeted $90 for calls, but the ones that you actually need would be $90. And that would be a wood duck, a 6-in-1 whistle, and a good entry level mallard duck call. And then $150 for a canoe. The canoe was the last thing that I put on there, because from the time you and I did our hunt in, what was that, December of last year?
Yep.
Until mid-October, I was scouring the internet for I wanted either a old beat up Old Town canoe, because I'm from Maine and I have a love and affinity for Old Town. Also, they're just indestructible.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if you got one built in the 80s or if it was like one of those aluminum ones that they built for like a short period, you're going to get a great canoe, no matter how rough it looks. And that's how I was going to keep it in the inexpensive realm, because I knew what I wanted to do, and spending $1,000 on a brand new canoe would be easy, but once again, it wouldn't fit in that whole thing. So with all of those numbers added up, it was still $550. And with all of that work and all of that effort, I still killed one duck. Me and a friend went out like every other day, every day that we could. And we went out and we put in a lot of soggy mornings, breaking through frozen ice, walking across beaver dams, falling in rivers. It was an education in all of the wrong things to do. And it was all on public land. And I wouldn't have traded it for the world. So for all of that, getting like a duck is pretty expensive, but that was like the cost of the education.
Well, if you're justifying cost per duck, I mean, if you want to bring it down, that, you know, you can tell your wife, like, hey, I want to make it worth it. So I got to get more ducks. I got to go hunting more, you know?
Exactly. And it works for a time. And then here's all the ways that I just went wrong. And this was a part, once again, the cost of the education. I went through two pairs of waders. Technically, I went through three pairs of waders because on the second time out, that brand new set of cheapskate waders, the rubber and the crotch split right open. And so I was crossing a frozen stream, and I put one leg straight through the ice, and I feel an immediate like flush of cold water. And then I end up, you know, breaking through the ice the rest of the way to get out of there. And I was completely drenched.
Oh, God.
We still went to the hole. We still did not kill any ducks. And then on our walking back, we found a different route. I was practically hypothermic. And so then I had to return my first set of waders, tell them that this brand new set, was messed up, and it had to have been a factory problem and not me doing a split through the ice. And then when the second pair of waders had a pinhole leak right at the top of the knee, and by the time we were out of ankle deep water, my left foot was completely soaked. I was like, that is it with the cheap waders. And I went and bought a third pair of waders that are much better. So budget just in waders had already exceeded the $500. I bought way more ammunition than what I'm willing to tell anyone on your podcast.
You don't want to get put on a list somewhere, huh?
No, I'm not disclosing how much money I spent, but let's just say that I'm good for duck hunting for a little while. Duck, geese, the whole thing. And I have spent a lot more money on decoys, which is part of what I'm going to go over, the optional stuff that will just make your life so much better. I spent $30 on a blind bag. It's one of the name brand ones, and I bought it on a used website. Man, it is tight, compact. It's good for the batteries that you bring out for your fancy movement decoys. It holds your shells. It holds your lunch. It's got a coffee holder. You really want a blind bag. $60 for a Mojo fly down. It's like, you can buy any brand, but Mojo is like the name in the game. $40 on a different type of movement thing. They're called dribblers and ripplers. There's a whole variety of move. Like, you want the water moving at all times.
Yeah. So just it so prevents. For listeners, when you say these movers, you're talking about like the contraption where decoys are kind of like strung to, or are you talking about something different?
So the one I got is a duck butt. So there's the full size decoys, and then the smaller ones where it looks like the duck has flipped itself, you know, head first into the water and is eating the vegetation inside of the shoreline. So under the water.
Yeah.
And so in them doing that, they're kicking, they're doing other stuff. And what they're doing is they're making waves. And so in order to have a realistic set, you have the fly down with its wings spinning, causing like movement and light to flare for any flying by birds so that they can see that other ducks are landing in your set. And then also off to the side, you have one of those motion decoys to basically ripple the water up and down so that it's not glass still. Because as you saw, like when we were just watching the ducks after we limited it out, when we were just watching them, playing and fighting and posturing and like sunning themselves. They were making a ruckus. And so that's kind of what you want in your set, is to have ripples, have movement, have a believable scenario based on the hole that you're in. So that's.
And you said you got a few of those, or you got one dribbler, one type of rippler, and then another, like, wings out, like a visual one?
So my friend was the one that bought the mojo and the rippler. So it was $60 and $40.
Okay.
Which again, going back to that first podcast we did on Suicide Ducks, is you have to do this as a group. Unless you're willing to just shell out a ton of money and you're willing to go out into a blind by yourself. Like, it's a group sport. I'm learning to know, like, it's more about your time, like, enjoying the fruit of your effort inside the blind together with friends, more than just, you know, lugging gear and shooting a duck and going home. And then the last thing from the optional, it will make your life a lot better, is a jet sled. Jet sled is the name brand, but I mean, you, like, in the whitetail world, it's just a drag.
Okay.
Or like if you're in a state that freezes up, you're the sled that you drag all your ice fishing stuff out with. But you need something additional that is almost like it's a little baby canoe. It's basically like a really rugged bathtub. So,
and that's a lot just of the for times decoys.
Yep, a lot of the times, like, you're slogging through ankle deep mud for hundreds of yards, and if you can just get a little bit of buoyancy, and you can not have all of those decoys like slapping you in the back of the head every single time you fall down, it makes your life much better.
I believe it. Yeah. So you're saying jet sled, good decoy bag. Hard lesson: if you can do decoys as a group, like with some buddies who you're gonna go with anyway, just to ease that cost and setup and everything. And then
exactly, and weight. You're also
go ahead. Sorry,
spreading the weight. You're also spreading the weight, and you're able to set up a decoy spread twice the size.
That's a good point too. Yeah. And then I guess waiters. Would you say you get what you pay for kind of deal?
More than that, like, that could be your life. Like, it's a pretty big deal. And I know First Light and a whole bunch of other companies, like, we joke that you're paying for the symbol that's on the side of them. But man, the quality of a set of Sitka waders or the Redhead waders over just your run of the mill. I just got mine from a box store. It was the cheapest set of rubber waders I could find, and it was in their fishing department. So I'm not knocking on them. They will keep you dry if you're on a boat and if you got to get in the water like once in a while.
Yeah.
But you definitely get what you pay for. And so that's going to be a purchase that I make certainly for next season.
Are there any other purchases you're willing to share on here, or do you feel like you're pretty well prepped and just add one or two little things here and there?
I'm learning more and more the more folks that I talk to and the more times I get to share with an experienced guy in the blind, that I have just scratched the surface on knowing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty funny all of the pitfalls that I've been falling into, because every single experienced duck hunter that I've had the pleasure of sharing coffee with, they're like, yeah, I did the same thing, man. You'll get to it, buy a couple things a year, keep your marriage intact, and eventually you know, you'll be able to afford, you know, X, Y, and Z. Because the other thing is that once you get proficient, or once you get accustomed to, or like you learn to get good at certain kinds of duck hunting, like in certain areas, you realize that, man, ducks and geese are everywhere, and you want and need different types of things depending on the scenario that you're handed. Then you get into all of the other ways of hunting, whether it be on cut cornfields, using pit blinds and layout blinds, getting into silhouettes and other stuff, and like flagging Canadian geese and snow geese with like giant spreads, or going into like mud flats or flooded timber and having to mud bottom your way into those areas, or using a floating blind, like the cheapskate method, which, to be honest, that's probably, until I get good at calling and decoying, I'm probably just going to have to do that, where I'm just either walking in and doing a jump shoot, or using my kayak and shooting from a kayak, which has, I will tell you without embarrassing myself, that has a pretty steep learning curve as well. And you don't want to mess that up and perhaps roll your kayak. It's embarrassing and hilarious, and it really shortens your hunt when almost fall out of a kayak and plunge your shotgun into the mud.
And hopefully still retain it, depending on how deep the water is.
Yeah, I'll say I definitely retained it. But
yeah,
I mean, hypothetically. So I will share two things that I am going to upgrade, is get a semi-automatic shotgun. I'm leaning towards a 20 gauge, one, so that my son can wield it during turkey season this year, and two, because it might be the only thing on the shelf that I'm seeing is available for ammunition and stuff.
Yeah.
And it's a really popular gun.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm going to invest in one, if not two, of those high-end expensive calls, because once again, like the waiters, you get what you paid for, and it's easier to get a exceptional sound out of a really well-tuned instrument than it is just some cheap thrown together made in China.
And it's like, as you pull a thread, it's like there's just more to pull, you know. You're like, oh wow, I want to look into this, I want to do this, I want to see how this works, I want to try this call. So that's cool. No, I'm glad you're into it. I'm glad that you've encouraged me to come down and do it. I definitely like it, and it's not something I would have thought about if I wasn't in contact with you. So I'm happy about that. It's really cool. So cool. Any save rounds? I think that was pretty good. Hopefully it doesn't deter people from duck hunting, the cost. And it was a great hunt. Anything else you have on your mind or takeaways?
I wanted to confirm that I still have no idea if suicide ducks are a real thing. A friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, said that they will dive down into the reeds, and they would rather die at like clinching onto a reed than allow you the satisfaction of taking them home.
Yeah.
But it's anecdotal. I don't know if there's actually anyone that does the evidence on it. So I'm thinking that they just, I've seen them pop down and then come up about a minute and a half later, hundreds of yards away.
Oh, okay.
So I think that they're just exceptional swimmers, and they use the little paddlers, and then they dive down into the mud. They hold what they got as long as they got, and they pop up somewhere else that is out of your line of sight.
All right. Well, I think that basically covers down on the hunt and everything. So, thanks for coming on the podcast, and yeah, we'll talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for listening today. If you enjoyed this podcast, be sure to like and subscribe. And if you'd like to support this podcast to sustain future episodes, feel free to click on the listener support link in the show notes. There'll be more content coming. And if there are any questions or comments, you can reach me on Instagram at Outdoors with Steve or at Pivotal Outdoors.